morning, and the clerk will call the first case if counsel are ready to proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Piven to argue for appellant, and Mr. Scott Lovegrass to argue for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Plaintiff asked this court to render an award for the $8.6 million in attorney's fees originally requested. This request is consistent with the Texas Supreme Court's rendering judgment for attorney's fees in the Ragsdale case cited in our brief. The court in that case recognized the general rule that the testimony of an interested witness, though not contradicted, does no more than raise a question of fact. But Ragsdale explains that there is an exception to this rule where the testimony is not contradicted by any other witness or, more relevant to this case, by attendant circumstances, provided that the testimony is clear, direct, positive, and free from contradictions, inaccuracies, and circumstances tending to cast suspicion on that testimony. In such a case, the testimony is taken as true as a matter of law, and in the context of applicable law, reviewed de novo. In the Reliance National Indemnity case, also cited in our brief, the Texas Supreme Court confirmed that a fact not in dispute or a fact conclusively established becomes a matter of law such that it should be considered de novo on appeal like all matters of law. Applied to the circumstances here, the trial court admitted without qualification or challenge of any kind supplemental evidence that was uncontroverted that the time spent by plaintiff's counsel in prosecuting the three actions on three separate fronts was both reasonable and necessary, and that the hourly rates of plaintiff's counsel were reasonable. The trial court had ample opportunity to ask questions concerning these matters, or even in theory, to retain its own expert. But the trial court never asked a single question regarding the time spent by plaintiff's counsel or the hourly rates charged by plaintiff's counsel. The trial court declined the opportunity to ask a question of Professor Jeffrey Miller, the leading authority on attorney's fees and class actions, whose primary job is teaching law at NYU. Professor Miller confirmed that the time spent by plaintiff's counsel in prosecuting the claims here was reasonable and necessary. He also confirmed that the hourly rates of plaintiff's counsel are well within reasonable and are commensurate with those of firms litigating matters pertaining to shareholder rights around the country. Mr. Enoch, who needs no introduction here, was clear that when facing the biggest company in the world and challenging its effort to spend $41 billion to acquire another behemoth company, both having no limit of resources available to vigorously defend this case, plaintiff's counsel had to call all hands on deck and leave no stone unturned. And that was in order to achieve a favorable, to attempt to achieve a favorable result. Mr. Enoch testified that based on the time spent by plaintiff's counsel in prosecuting the case, it was reasonable and necessary, and he confirmed that based on the rates charged by law firms both in Texas and elsewhere who defend or prosecute high-stakes litigation like this case on an hourly basis, the hourly rates of plaintiff's counsel are well within the range of reasonable and in some instances actually low. The district court admitted into evidence without qualification the fee comparison chart at tab 11 of plaintiff's appendix upon which Mr. Enoch referred, or to which Mr. Enoch referred. The district court never challenged or questioned plaintiff's counsel's second set of affidavits attached to my own, confirming that the time spent by those firms was reasonable and necessary to represent their respective clients and the class they sought to represent, and that the hourly rates they charged are reasonable and consistent, both in their own geographic locations and in the community of counsel who litigate shareholder rights matters like this one. The trial court also declined the opportunity to question counsel from firms involved in the Delaware action and the federal action who appeared at the December hearing for just that purpose. Consistent with the discussion in Ragsdale, the testimony and evidence before the trial court was not unreasonable, incredible, questionable, or in defiance of common sense. There was no suggestion below that the testimony and evidence freely admitted into the record below was contradicted, inaccurate, or suspicious. Ragsdale recognized the exception to the general rule both where an opportunity to contradict the evidence existed and in a default situation, which is analogous to that here, where defendants agreed not to oppose the request for attorney's fees and expenses in an amount of up to $8.8 million. The testimony of the firms representing plaintiffs, Professor Jeffrey Miller and Mr. Enoch, was never challenged as being incredible or inconsistent, both factors considered by the Seventh District Court of Appeals in Amarillo when it was following Ragsdale in the County of Beaver, Oklahoma case, also cited in our brief.
Mr. Piven?
Yes, Justice Walker.
It looks to me like the area that the trial court had difficulty with was the lodestar under 42I1. And so just take us through the math. I mean, how are you, mathematically, how are you arriving at the 8.8?
Well, the lodestar is what the court awarded was the 3.8 or 9. I can't remember the exact. But the lodestar was simply the hours spent by the plaintiff's counsel times their respective hourly rates. It was simply a calculation. It was the judge's job to determine whether the hours spent were appropriate in light of what was at stake. And the testimony below was uncontradicted in that regard, and the judge never questioned that, given the opportunity to do so. And also, the hourly rates were then presented to the court without contradiction. The first time around, the court had questions with regard to the adequacy of the testimony before the court with regard to whether or not it was those rates were reasonable, and the supplemental evidence overwhelmingly supported that those rates were reasonable. Have I responded to your question?
So your answer is that the 8.8 is reached strictly by number of hours times hourly rate.
No, the award below was 3.9 or whatever it was. The total was and it was that amount that is strictly a matter of math. The second step required by 42I subpart 1 is to apply some of the factors, the 1.04B factors, to enhance that lodestar. And the enhancement that is requested is 2.17 times, which falls literally within the middle of the 25% to 400% range allowed by the rule. And in fact, as we pointed out in our brief, what really the way this rule should operate is that the court should, independent of the restriction, 25% to 400%, come up with a number. And then, if that number is more than 400%, just like in the punitive damage limits that apply in Texas, and I believe also with regard to the medical malpractice caps that apply, the juries are not advised of those caps. They render their decision, their verdict, and then the court just mechanically applies the cap. And that's very much like should have been done here. May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you.
I have a question. Under Rule 42H3, once the court has its hearing, the rule says that the court must state its findings and conclusions in writing or oral on the record. Am I correct that the only thing that we have is the judge's letter?
We have a brief statement at the end of the October 1st hearing explaining the court's inexperience in this field and correctly stating that there is a two-step process in establishing what the attorney's fee should be. And then the court, as I'll address in a minute in my argument, allowed after receiving the supplemental evidence, allowed her plenary power to lapse by operation of law.
So we don't have anything other than her statements on the record after that hearing.
And the October 8th letter, which it is our contention is incomplete. And again, I think I will be addressing that in the remainder of my argument.
The $3,972,367.75 is exactly 100% of the attorney's fees figured on the basis of the number of hours spent, about 7,000 times the hourly rates of all the attorneys that were identified and testified by affidavit and otherwise.
That's correct, Your
Honor. So he didn't leave, the trial judge did not leave out one penny of the hourly fees times the number of hours spent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the whole issue is whether the trial court accurately assessed the provision in 42I, number one, that once you determine the lodestar figure, that you are to multiply the number of hours reasonably worked times a reasonable hourly rate.
Not correct, Your Honor.
Plus, the attorney's fees awarded must be in the range of 25% to 400%.
That's not exactly correct, if I may.
Tell me why I didn't read that right. I thought I just read it right from the rule.
Okay. Because what the rule says is that there are two steps. The first step is you first determine the reasonable number of hours that were necessary to properly represent the client. You then determine reasonable hourly rates for the attorneys who did perform the representation, and then you reach a lodestar number. That's the first step, separate and apart from anything to do with the multiplier.
That's what I thought I just said.
Okay, then I misunderstood.
What I read in the record was about 7,000 hours.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then there were various testimonies, including Professor Miller's assessment of various kinds of arrangements in the way that the attorney's records were compiled in affidavit form in terms of the number of hours spent. And those kind of factors were what was applied to get to the number I just read you, which is the $3,972,367.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so then, as I understand your complaint and what you're concerned about on appeal, is that you feel like that the trial court, in reaching the second step in 42I1, should have applied a greater amount of a multiple to those lodestar amounts rather than just give 100% of the lodestar as the dollar amount of the attorney's fees.
Your Honor, the trial court never applied the second step, ignored the enhancement part, and I believe, if I may be allowed to proceed, I will.
Okay, well, I'm just understanding that the trial court had the discretion in terms of what the rule said, only award 25% of that lodestar amount, had the trial court decided to do that.
If the trial court proceeded through the proper process, that's correct.
How do we know she
didn't? We don't know how the court arrived, other than by making an assumption, which again is something I will address. The court made an assumption that was impermissible under the statute. The assumption was that the hourly rates were already enhanced by the collective Johnson factors, and that's not rational because the Johnson factors don't all apply to rates. Well, in the letter, she absolutely says, if I may quote, Your Honor.
And I realize that's what it says in the letter, but how do we know that after the second hearing, she didn't decide 100% without findings of fact, how do we know?
Well, what we know is that she abused her discretion by not issuing findings of fact under 42H subpart 3.
So why shouldn't we get those?
Because, in this case, Your Honor, this is the equivalent of undisputed testimony below, which is the equivalent of, in a summary judgment setting, where there's no genuine dispute as to a material fact. There is no genuine dispute as to a material fact. As a consequence, The only issue is one of law. And since it is a matter of law, this court has the jurisdiction to render, just like in Ragsdale, an award for attorney's fees as requested.
Well, it is uncontroverted that it's 2.17 is a reasonable multiplier, and there wasn't any testimony or evidence to the contrary, correct?
That's absolutely correct. More importantly, the testimony that was uncontroverted was with regard to the number of hours spent and the hourly rate charged. The court never, ever went to the second step, which was the enhancement step, and took the factors that are the result obtained and the other factors, the most important being the contingency nature of the representation, never considered the fact that the agreed fee up to $8.8 million, which is the what was to be applied for. The agreement was that there would be no objection provided that the only amount applied for did not exceed $8.8 million. There was an absolute agreement that if a court of competent jurisdiction, which includes this court, and we believe this court can render, that if this court renders the award, and it is no more than $8.8 million, that the defendants will pay that amount without objection.
So it's your position then that the trial court properly computed the Lodestar amount, but to the extent that she either, one, included the Johnson factors in the hourly rate, that was an abuse of discretion?
No.
Right?
That's not our contention.
Okay.
Our contention is that there are three steps in essence. You take some of the Johnson factors, and we've identified them in the brief, that apply to the time spent. If I may. The 104B factors are the time and labor required and the novelty. That goes to how much time you need to spend to properly represent your clients. And then the difficulty of the questions involved and is also one that goes to that issue. The skill requisite to perform that service goes to the quality of the lawyers that you need to represent the plaintiffs in a case like this, and that goes to where can you find those lawyers and how much would you have to pay them if you had to pay them by the hour. The likelihood of the particular employment in this case precluding the lawyer from spending time on other cases, while the court did address that, it is something that is taken as holistically as a whole, and in that case, clearly, there were some lawyers who spent, as the judge pointed out, 6 hours. There were some firms that spent much, much more than that. And while there might be 180 lawyers in a law firm, that doesn't mean that all of those lawyers were performing work in this case. It's the lawyers who were actually performing the work. The fee customarily charged for similar services is something that goes to the overall reasonableness of the fee, and in this case really goes to enhancement of the Lodestar, and that is because in these kinds of cases, unlike a personal injury case where the fee may be a mathematical 1/3 or 40% or whatever it is that's agreed to in a retainer agreement, in this case the customary fee is a fee that is determined by enhancing the Lodestar because of the risk undertaken in a case like this, for example, of opposing defendants with absolutely unlimited means who can spend all the money in the world to defeat you if that's their choice. In this case, that's not what happened. In this case, the plaintiffs achieved the best result possible. They got all of the disclosures that they thought were appropriate to allow the shareholders, to make an informed vote. And in this case, they had that information. And if that information was such that it would have convinced them that they weren't getting a fair deal, they would have voted down the transaction. But given full information, they chose not to vote down the transaction.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. For the reasons set forth in our response brief, appellees take no position on today's appeal.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely, sir.
I read this order of October 4th, 2010, as a multiple page order and final judgment like it's entitled, replete with findings, both factual findings and findings of law. And in looking at paragraph 14, there is a specific use of the words, or specific uses of the words, which some the court finds to be fair, reasonable, and in accordance with applicable law. And when you look at the provisions dealing with attorney's fees in the stipulation and agreement of compromise, settlement, and release, the negotiated position in paragraph 17 is that the plaintiff intend to petition the court for an award of up to $8 million. Now, isn't that specifically what happened? Petition for up to $8 million, and they got $3,972,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I have seen what you all filed, and I read all both of the hearings, there was never anything by any of the defendants except to do what it says, and that is not to object.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that defendants and now appellees have fully complied with the stipulation and taken absolutely no opposition to plaintiff's application.
But it wasn't negotiated that the dollar amount of the attorney's fees would be $8,800,000 with expenses.
That's entirely correct, Your Honor.
The negotiated position is that that matter was left under the Texas law, because the stipulation agreement specifically provides that it's governed by Texas law, not New York, not Delaware, it's Texas. And under Texas law, when you submit that to the trial judge, then the trial judge listens to the motions and any evidence presented and makes a determination. That's what Judge Sutter did in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, to address Justice Myers' question, I'd like to read from the actual agreement. Plaintiff and class counsel in the action intend to petition the court for an award of up to $8,800,000 for attorney's fees and expenses. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. And I don't think there's any question that the defendants expected that the petition for attorney's fees would be $8.8 million. And the defendants agreed to pay $8.8 million if a court of competent jurisdiction like this one would award it without any objection. There's the agreement was that they simply would not oppose it, provided that the petition didn't seek more than $8.8 million. And if today I asked the court for $8.8 plus one more dollar, they would then have the right under the agreement to oppose that petition. In this situation, they did not have that right. And in just like in Ragsdale, where the court addressed a default situation where there is no one on the other side who's given the opportunity to address the evidence, and which was uncontroverted, that's exactly what the court had the right to do. In this case, was to accept the evidence. It was uncontroverted, and it just so happened that the default in this, the agreement in this case, was simply like a default. And so Ragsdale recognizes that once the evidence is established, that evidence is uncontroverted, it is not subject to suspicion or question. The court didn't ask a single question. And the findings of fact that the court referred to that were in the final order really go to the issue of the class and the settlement and the certification of the class. The court did not, in that order, have findings of fact and conclusions of law with regard to the attorney's fees as required by 42H subpart 3. And so in this situation, it was beyond dispute that the court below did not exercise its discretion. It chose not to exercise its discretion. The court went so far as to say, for example, I've never seen rates this high. So because of that, I'm going to assume that the rates already are enhanced. That's not permitted under 42I subpart 1 to enhance the rates.
Okay, that's the question that I was trying to ask you earlier. I mean, I'm understanding your position to be that the trial court either, one, abused its discretion by enhancing the, by assuming the rates were already enhanced.
Right.
Or enhanced, in thinking they were enhanced already under the Johnson factors, or two, then by not applying the Johnson factors to reach the 2.17 multiplier. In other words, that's
correct. What the court did was impermissible. The court below said that the rates are already enhanced. That's not what the court's allowed to do. The court must find rates that are reasonable. The
and
testimony
then the Johnson
below.
Johnson factors are applied to reach the multiplier.
Right. Some of the Johnson factors are applied to reach the multiplier. Some of the Johnson factors, and the brief is very clear on this. There are certain Johnson factors that should be applied to determine whether the time spent was appropriate. This was a very difficult case. It was intense. It was against the best lawyers in the world and the biggest companies in the world. And so it required some really hard work. It required sifting through a lot of data, consulting with experts, and doing what was necessary to achieve the disclosures that were achieved. And as Professor Arthur Miller, who of Wright and Miller fame, testified, this was an extraordinary result. And in cases that were similar, where even such a result was not obtained, that were much smaller, the fees were much bigger in comparison. What was at stake here was $41 billion. There was a case that was described in the brief that involved the New York Stock Exchange that was a $9 billion deal, not a $41 billion deal. And in that case, the fee for the same exact result, or I can't say it's exact, but very, very similar, was $8.5 million in Delaware. And I understand that this is not Delaware. But the court abused its discretion, had the opportunity to apply the factors, and never mentioned the word contingency, never mentioned the word that you incentivize as a matter of public policy lawyers to take cases like this on a contingency, never mentioned the fact that this fee was the subject of an agreement between sophisticated parties when I think the court can take judicial notice of the fact that the defendants would not have expected the prayer for, or the request for fees to be less than the agreed upon $8.8 million.
I just don't think you agreed on that point, sir. I mean, you keep using the words you agreed upon. And once you agree that you read the paragraph, it's paragraph 17, and I just read a moment ago, and it says agree that you can
petition
the court.
Absolutely. That's right. And if this court awards $8.8 million, they'll pay it. They don't object to it. All we're saying is that provided that we don't ask for more than 8.8, and provided that a court awards 8.8, they'll pay it. They've agreed.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments here today. They've been very helpful. We appreciate you being here, and we appreciate them. It's always helpful to have some math explained to us. So you are dismissed. You're free to leave, or you may stay. Your choice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel in the next case is free to come forward. SBG Development versus New Rock Group.